From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Sudan is a country that hasn't generated a lot of positive headlines in the past few decades, but all that changed in April when the country's longtime dictator, General Omar al-Bashir, was ousted and arrested after months of protests in the capital, Khartoum. Al-Bashir had been in power for 30 years and had commanded Sudan during much of its horrific civil war that resulted in millions of deaths and the independence of South Sudan back in 2011. He also oversaw Sudan's violent crackdown in the western region of Darfur in the early 2000s that killed around 300,000 people and resulted in his indictment for genocide and crimes against humanity before the International Criminal Court. Now, the protesters that hastened al-Bashir's exit have been heartened by the tolerance and even support from some in Sudan's military who backed their goals of a democratic transition to civilian government. But that support from Sudan's military leaders dwindled as weeks passed, and it culminated on June 3rd when the military, led by a militia from Darfur, attacked unarmed protesters in Khartoum and killed more than 100 people. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the political crisis in Sudan. Has one military dictator been ousted only to be replaced by another? So in a few minutes, we'll hear from three experts who've been following this situation closely. Up first, we're going to bring in NPR's East Africa correspondent, Eder Peralta. He's been covering this story closely, and he joins us now from Nairobi, Kenya. Eder, welcome.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Let's just back up a little bit. Remind us when these protests started. What were people upset about?
So this started in December. The government was having huge economic problems, and they stopped some of the subsidies on some basic items, including bread, and the prices of those basic commodities went up. People took to the streets, but the protests very quickly became much broader than economic protests. They became about the ouster of this regime, the ouster of Omar al-Bashir. And, you know, that sort of just snowballed into a real movement that, as you said, culminated in April when protesters marched into an area that holds the headquarters of all the military branches of Sudan, and they set up this huge camp. It was reminiscent of Occupy Wall Street, except much bigger. And then in April, the military ousted longtime leader Omar al-Bashir in a military coup, and you know there was huge celebration across the country. People from all over Sudan started pouring into Khartoum, into the sit-in, and you know there was music, there was graffiti. Women who were a huge part of this movement, you know, were hugely represented in this sit-in, and you know, it all sort of has gone to a very bad place for protesters. After the military broke up this sit-in with
talk to us what happened. What happened on June 3rd then? Because the people had been protesting outside the gates of the main military compound there for some time, seemingly without a lot of difficulty.
Yeah, I mean, the military was sort of saying you can do this freely. But you know what has happened in Sudan is there seems to be a split between the army, the armed forces, and the rapid support forces, which was the militia group that led the genocide in Darfur. It became the rapid support forces.
So these are the guys that were formerly known as like the Janjaweed or some of them.
The Janjaweed, right. And so, you know, the protesters, I mean, when I talked to them, I kept saying because this protest ground was just, it was surrounded by rapid support forces. It was guys in pickup trucks with machine guns and RPGs. And I sort of kept telling the protesters, you know, why are you all so comfortable here? And they really believed that the armed forces, that all the security apparatus was on their side. And then, you know, what happened in June is that the rapid support forces and some of police moved into the sit-in and they opened fire on what were peaceful protesters. and they killed, according to opposition groups, more than 100 people. Some people were thrown into the Nile. There were lots of reports of women who were raped. The images of that day, you can see security forces using whips to beat people. They were using sticks. They open, if you listen to the gunfire in a lot of these videos, it's automatic gunfire. And I think what that accomplished is it scared a lot of people in Khartoum. It scared a lot of the protesters in Khartoum. They shut down the internet, they militarized the whole city, and, you know, people went back to their homes. I think right now, protesters are starting to come back on the street. There's a big protest planned, because what protesters want is for the military to get out of power and hand it to civilians. But we're still at that stage where that is still being negotiated and decided.
Yeah, talk to us about this general. I guess he goes by the name Hamidi, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. He's the leader of the RSF paramilitary force. What has he said about what's happened and the killing of these unarmed protesters?
Well, I mean, Hameti says that he, that they've ordered an investigation. And also, he sort of keeps using this line that the government has used quite a bit, that it was not RSF forces, that it was not government forces who did this, that it was people pretending to be government forces who did this. The opposition says that they don't trust Hemeti or any of the security forces, and they will not negotiate directly with them. I think what is becoming clear, very clear, in Sudan is that Hemeti is going from being a general to becoming a politician. Over the last couple of weeks, he has held political rallies. He's very clearly trying to make a way for him to become the next leader of Sudan.
And sorry, we mentioned that al-Bashir had been indicted by the International Criminal Court on genocide war crimes charges in Darfur. Hamidi was his guy in Darfur, is that not correct?
He was his enforcer in Darfur, and Bashir was sort of abandoned by his security forces when they ousted him, and now however they have not turned him over to the ICC, but they say that he will face justice in Sudan. They've charged him with corruption, but I think when you talk to protesters, when you talk to analysts, they are very suspicious of this military council. To a lot of people, it seems like this is just a continuation of, the 30 years of Bashir without Bashir.
Well, Eder Peralta, we have to let you go. There's a lot more to discuss. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Jason.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the political crisis in Sudan. We just heard from NPR's East Africa correspondent, Eder Peralta. For more on this, we're going to bring in three other experts who've been on the ground covering the upheaval. Joining us from Chicago is Jason Patinkin. He's a veteran Africa correspondent who's reported for a number of news outlets, including The Washington Post, Al Jazeera, and Reuters. And with us in Nairobi is Ahmed El-Zobir. He's the Sudan researcher for the human rights group Amnesty International. Ahmed, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And also on the line from Nairobi is Tommy Oladipo. He's the Africa security correspondent for BBC's Africa service. Tommy, welcome to Global Journalist.
Great to be on the program.
Let's talk a bit more about this protest movement that has been trying to negotiate with the Transitional Military Council, which includes some folks who were involved in the atrocities in Darfur. What's the state of those negotiations now?
Well, there are no talks going on at the moment. You have the two sides. The civilian side is mostly a coalition of people from certain parties, political parties, but also led by what's called the Sudan Professionals Association. These are a group of professionals, doctors and the like, who led these protests. So they had been sitting down with the military and having negotiations as to how to go forward. But then they got to a point where both sides started hardening their stances. They couldn't agree on certain things, and they the talks fell apart. The civilian side then decided they were going to have a strike. They had 2 days of a national strike, and then the military responded, you know, dispersing some of their protests, and that's when they decided they would have this main sit-in where they gathered around the military headquarters, and that's when you had the incident of the June 3rd. So at the moment, they're trying to get, you know, there's attempts by the African Union to bring these two parties together, but they're still talking through a mediator as to even whether they will have talks in the first place.
And Ahmed El-Zobir, if I could bring you in, what's your sense of what people's mood is there now in Sudan? I know you have a lot of friends and family there you visited recently.
Well, I think the first reaction, is especially after the 3rd of June, is a shock. You know, people were so shocked by what happened. Never expected to see something like that happen in their capital, Khartoum. The second emotion, like a lot of sadness, because that's also, you know, end of months of Ramadan and the Eid of, you know, people usually during that period of time feel happy and joyful and celebrate and visit each other. So people just stayed at home. They never bothered even to call each other because of this kind of feeling. I think at the moment, people just going through the motion, how we can resist what's happened and how we can move forward, because they, you know, they sustain this kind of oppression and suppression for such a long period of time during Bashir period. I don't think, especially young people, I don't want to that kind of experience to continue with these new military generals.
And Jason Patinkin, if I can bring you back into this, then you were in Khartoum on the date of this massacre. What was your experience?
It was a very strange day and a very heartbreaking day as well. The attack started at around dawn, and we could hear gunshots from the hotel we were staying at, but the military or the RSF actually surrounded the hotel to prevent foreign journalists from reporting or going outside or seeing what was happening. So the day of the massacre was a bit surreal, because we got a little bit of information from, you know, from what we could gather. But overall, we as foreign journalists were basically locked into our hotels by the military. Over the following days, we were able to get out and go onto the streets and try to find out what happened. And it was a very tense situation. There was, you know, RSF all over the streets, roadblocks almost everywhere. You know, we visited a hospital, for example, and there were just dozens and dozens of wounded people there. And even the hospitals were being attacked. At one point we even had to hide inside a closet in one of the hospitals, because the RSF was trying to come in and look for wounded protesters who was in there. So it was really a chaotic, terrible situation.
Well, Tommy Oladipo, if I could follow up with you as well, then, you know, we heard Eder Peralter talking a little bit about divisions within the military itself, and it does seem like for a long time the protesters felt like they had the military on their side. What do we know about sort of divisions among the officer corps within Sudan here? I think a lot of people were surprised that the guns were turned on these protesters.
Yeah, as Jason mentioned, and you know, the presence of the military has been there for right through, and I guess the people expected that they would get the support of the military as they went on to this transition. But what then happened is you have Hemeti's group, the Rapid Support Forces, as you've mentioned, they're part of this military regime, and he's actually the deputy head officially. And then you have the army. And I guess when you look at general armies around the world, there is a certain pride that they have of being military people, of having come through the ranks and putting on the uniform. And then you have the RSF, who basically are militia who have been given uniforms. And so there is, first of all, that I guess the mistrust and the lack of respect from the army side. But then also there's the fact that Hemeti is placing himself as the face of this government. He is, you know, placing himself like a politician. I attended a meeting where he was the other day, meeting tribal leaders, trying to woo them. So there is that division. And you find that even today, for example, in certain neighborhoods, there's a twin city or tri-city of Khartoum called Omdurman, just next to the main Khartoum city, where the army has a strong presence. There seem to be protests, mini protests, but nonetheless protests going on there. And the army is not really interfering. So to a degree, the people will feel that the army is softer towards them than the RSF is. And we see those right through the time of the protest. There were rumors that, you know, army and RSF people had standoffs, for example. So that just shows at the moment that even with the TMC, the Transitional Military Council, when they were having the talks with the civilian opposition, you know, there were people in there who said that it was the RSF who were the hardliners, who were the ones refusing to give in to the civilians. Not to say that the army does not want its own presence in the transitional government and to remain in power, but it appears as if the RSF seems to be the harder liners of the group.
Well, Ahmed El-Zobier, if I could bring you in as well. You work for Amnesty, obviously a major human rights group. The RSF does have this long history in Darfur. They have also received funding from the European Union to help stop the flow of migrants from elsewhere in Africa through to Europe. What concerns does Amnesty have about them possibly having the upper hand now in taking control of the central government?
Well, as you know, we've been reporting the situation in Darfur since 2003, since the conflict started there. And I think one of our key call at that time is like to disarm the Janjaweed militia, which is actually adopted by the UN Security Council, the famous resolution 1556, which is called on the government of Sudan to disarm the Janjaweed militia. That's back in 2004. But then the National Congress Party government and Omar Bashir, they decided to rebrand this militia. I think around 2013, they call themselves the Rabbit Support Force. They give them a new name, but you know, majority of them, they were a part of that Janjaweed militia. So during also our reporting since 2014, 2015, 2016, and 17 and 18, any Amnesty International reports, we always, when we talk about the situation in Darfur, we always encounter that if there is an attack on villages or attack on civilian, especially IDP, internally displaced person, the name of the Rabbit Support Force will always come up. And I think in our last year, we recommended that to the UN Security Council when they renew the mandate of UNAMID, which is the peacekeeping operation in Darfur, they should not hand over their team sites to Rabbit Support Forces, because that's what we discovered been happening. So I think that we are glad to hear that today, or the last few days, that the government of Sudan decided not to hand over this team site to Rabbit Support Forces, but use it for, you know, which is the basic purpose of the peacekeeping mission, which is for health, education, facilities, to help the people of Darfur.
Well, it certainly sounds like there's still a level of violence there that might require that peacekeeping force. But we have to take just a quick break to remind you that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the political crisis in Sudan, where popular protests ousted dictator Omar al-Bashir, only to see the military turn its guns on the protesters themselves. We're joined by the journalist Jason Patinkin, Ahmed El-Zobier of Amnesty International, and Tommy Oladipo of the BBC. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our video cast on YouTube. And Jason Patinkin, if I could bring you back into this as well, talk to us just a little bit about what the role of the U.S. has been in this standoff here. What has the Trump administration been saying?
The short answer is not much. The the Trump administration and the Obama administration before that really downgraded Sudan and South Sudan in terms of a priority in Africa. Sudan used to be the top Africa priority for Bush and was quite important under Clinton as well. But the last two administrations really have not engaged very much. We don't have an ambassador there. And from people I talk to, who from sources I have in the U.S. Governments, basically the U.S. was in some ways caught off guard. The State Department really downplayed the protests even after they began in December and built up. So the U.S. was really unprepared for this. When the military took over, there were few statements, and other countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt really took the lead role internationally, and they strongly back the military council. So the U.S. really didn't take up the...
Well, let me just stop you there. Why are these other countries, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, why are they backing this military council?
So, I mean, they basically have the opportunity to buy off a country, more or less. And Sudan is an extremely strategic nation in the Horn of Africa and in the Red Sea region. And all of this is part of the Saudi-UAE standoff with Iran and Qatar. And by putting tons of money into the new military regime, they've pledged $3 billion to that regime, they can bring Sudan's government on their side in this standoff or in this split in the Gulf region. And in particular, Hemeti, the commander of the RSF and the deputy head of the Transitional Military Council, his RSF troops are actually on the ground in Yemen fighting on behalf of the Saudi-UAE coalition. So Hemeti himself is crucial for their war in Yemen, and they are crucial for him because they pay his militia's salaries, more or less. So those Gulf countries really stepped in immediately to ensure that the military council would be in power and would have the international support it needed, whereas the U.S., which for decades has been pushing for a transition to democracy in Sudan, basically its eye was off the ball and missed the boat.
Well, Tommy Oladipo, what leverage do outsiders have in trying to get the military, this military council, Hemeti, to move in a more inclusive or democratic direction? Because it does sound like this situation could become potentially a lot more messy. There, you know, Sudan has a long history of violence, not just in Darfur and in South Sudan, but there are lots of local conflicts, many different ethnic groups with their own militias. You know, what could be done?
Well, again, I think as Jason mentioned, that the influence of the Gulf countries is probably what's key. Everybody else can say what they want to say, but as to what the impact of that will be, that remains to be seen. For example, the African Union suspended Sudan. That, I guess, was important for it to do, but how much impact will that have? I mean, that's difficult to say. For example, within the African Union, the current chair of the African Union is Egypt. The president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is a fan of Sudan, who's a supporter of the current military. So I think in that regard, I think you still have to go again through the Gulf. You can, for example, there have been talks of sanctions and things like that to be threatened against certain individuals who come in the way of establishing a democratic government. But these kinds of people have been there for a long time. They're people who have been wanted for a long time by, for example, the International Criminal Court, and they're still there. They're still in power. There's still people who have influence there. So again, I think a key way to go will be through these Gulf nations. The U.S. does have some influence over the Gulf nations in certain regards and can push them to an extent. So I guess that would be the workable way. But again, we've seen, you know, countries like Russia and China show some resistance in the UN Security Council when there have been issues of Sudan brought up, even though they did end up backing a statement against the violence, the 3rd of June violence. But again, I think it all points back to these Gulf countries who are putting money in and who are verbally also sort of on the side of the existing government.
And Ahmed El-Zobier, if I could bring you back in, it does seem like we're seeing a little bit of a repeat of what has happened in Zimbabwe, what happened in Egypt after the Arab Spring, where you see the ouster of a long-serving dictator, and then there's sort of hope for some sort of more democratic civilian transfer of power. Ultimately, you end up seeing a different general filling the president's chair. Is that what we're seeing here?
I think maybe a similar scenario, but maybe also we'll take different route in Sudan. I think the hope that I think these young generations have experienced, at least within the last 6 months, this kind of, you know, expectation for change and everything, I think that will keep pushing for change, serious change in Sudan. I'm sure the role of these Gulf countries, I think, should be influenced, not to support the military council. I think there is some kind of attempt now by the United States and UK, United Kingdom, and also some European countries to tell them, please don't support this military council. And I think if there is some kind of balance of power within Sudan, which is basically allow, especially the freedom of expression, freedom of association, people are, you know, allowed to do that, I think there will be kind of a momentum for better change scenario in Sudan rather than these other example you mentioned.
Well, we're short on time, but Jason Patinkin, I want to give you the last word. I mean, is there some room for optimism here? It does seem like the news has been kind of depressing here over the last couple of weeks. Is there some cause for hope?
Well, I think the main hope is with the protesters themselves, with the people of Sudan themselves. They are defiant. They are not giving up. They have, after the horrific massacre of June 3rd, there were a couple weeks of uncertainty, but now slowly the protests in the streets are starting again. And on Sunday, the protesters are planning for what they're calling a million march. So, you know, as many people as they can possibly get into the streets across Sudan. So this has been a protest movement that has done what no one has ever done before in Sudan. They overthrew al-Bashir after 30 years, and how many rebel groups or other protests have there been that attempted to do that? So we could be surprised. The people of Sudan themselves might be the key to making a positive change.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Ada Peralta, Jason Patinkin, Ahmed El-Zobier, and Tommy Oladipo. Our producer this week is Edom Kaseye, with assistance from Trevor Hook. Megan Smaltz is visual editor. Takia Thomas is audio engineer. Our director is Travis McMillan. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.